Welcome to Queer Writers of Crime, featuring interviews with renowned LGBTQ authors and up-and-coming talent in mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. I'm your host, Brad Shreve, and Justine is here to give her weekly recommendation. Hi, Justine. I think the name of today's episode should be the Sunshine Happy Positive Podcast.
There's no sunshine here in Southern California, so I don't know where you want me to get the rest of those ideas.
You can have a sunny day without a sunny day. I have good news and good news today.
Okay. All right. I'm ready. Hit me with it.
First, this is going to be the last week that people have to listen to us beg for reviews.
So bribe. We're bribing.
Yeah, we may do it down the road, but we'll do it for a shorter period of time. But this is the last time for this go around. So again, if you want a gift card worth $50, leave a review. The instructions are on the website. Most of you probably heard it. But anywhere in the world, just leave a review for the show, an honest review. And I'm still surprised how many we haven't gotten. We got a review from somebody named Mystery Rat. Now, do you know how long a lifespan is of a rat, Justine?
Okay, I don't really want to talk about rats if we're having a sunny, happy day.
Okay. I don't know what an average rat's lifespan is, but it can't be very long. Yet a rat took the time to write a review. So anybody can do it. The closing date is midnight, February 7th. So get the reviews by then, and not only give us the reviews, but send us an email with your real name, because it's not always your username.
Since we have listeners all over the world, you want to mention what time zone the midnight is?
Are we in standard time?
Yes.
Pacific Standard Time.
Okay.
So that's when I go to bed at midnight.
Okay. Yeah, you don't go to bed at midnight.
Okay, so now I have good news and good news.
More good news. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Stay silent and listen to the sound. Did you hear it?
I did not.
That's because I haven't put the special effects in yet.
Oh, good.
Had you heard it, you would have heard the wheel.
Oh, how exciting, exciting.
Wheel for awkward questions authors get.
Oh,
and,
good.
And here's the good news and the good news.
Yes.
The reason I stopped doing this is because it was right in the middle of the show, and it frequently cut into a really good flow of conversation. So I stopped doing it. Overwhelmingly, I have had people begging me to bring this thing back.
Yeah.
But there are some people that are glad it's gone.
Too bad on them.
No, not too bad on them. I'm going to make everybody happy.
Okay.
The wheel is back, but it will be the final segment of the show.
Okay, that sounds good.
It's how I'll wrap up the show, the last question. So if you like the wheel, listen to the entire show and we'll have some fun. Otherwise, you know when to stop.
I want to add a question to the wheel for awkward questions.
Okay, did you want to give it now?
Yeah, I think you should ask them, so why did you want to be on this show?
I will add that. And I also want to tell people, the old questions I used to ask, I got from several websites that said, questions not to ask authors.
Yes.
This time I surveyed dozens of authors as to what questions they got.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are the same. Some of them are a bit weird. We may get some real fun answers coming down the road.
Okay.
So those are my good news days. And I think everybody should be happy with that.
Yeah. We make everybody happy.
Yes. Happy. If you love the wheel, it's coming. If you hate the wheel, it's coming, but you don't have to listen to it.
Exactly.
So what good news do you have for us?
I've got a book that I think you and I, we talked about this book, and you said it was one of the first books that you had ever read when you discovered the gay mystery genre. And I said, I think I read that. And I ended up pulling up my Kindle and I ended up buying it in December of 2016. So it had been a long time since I read it, but I remember liking it quite a bit, and I picked it up and looked over and figured out why I liked it, and we're recommending it. It is called First You Fall. It's a Kevin Connor mystery by Scott Sherman. It won the 2009 Lambda Literary Mystery Award, Best Mystery, and it's the first in a trilogy. The second one is Second You Sin, and the third one is Third You Die.
Now, I want to say something. I have said on this show many times that Mark McNeice's Murder at Pride Lodge was the first gay mystery I ever read. I'm not so sure of that. It was his book or First You Fall. They both were right at the same time. And yes, they both sent me on this quest of, thank God there's LGBTQ mysteries out there.
Yes.
So
yes.
Anyway, go on.
Moving right along now. Anyway, the third one was published in 2012. And on the introduction, the acknowledgments, he said that it was the first book he had tried to write after becoming a parent. I believe he and his husband brought in 2 foster children. And it was as hard as he thought. And there's never been a book since then. So my guess is that it's even harder than he thought. If there's a sudden flurry of buying of his books, he may be willing to write some more. And that I always encourage people, if you want more books from an author, buy their books, recommend everybody else buy their books. There's nothing that will encourage an author to write more than sales.
And this is a fun book.
This is you've got a recommendation, a fun one?
Yeah, but that's my recommendation. You go on, okay, and you can give your recommendation.
Talk about stealing my thunder. So Kevin Connor is a high-end hooker. He falls into the old stereotype, hooker with a heart of gold. But at the prices he's charging and the people that he meets with, they all seem to be need a little bit of tender, loving care, and he gives it to them. He's always very pleasant. He doesn't take a client he doesn't want, and most of his clients are regulars. And he has very intriguing stories. There's the client who wanted him to dress up like a clown and throw water balloons at him. So, and he tells all of them with the same non-judgmental, accepting, gee, isn't this kind of fun sort of thing. You remember that, don't you?
I don't remember that, but I'm absolutely terrified of clowns. So I couldn't imagine finding that. I couldn't imagine finding that sexy in any way.
I don't know what to tell you. It's like everybody, whatever floats people's boats. And that's the kind of person he's got to hire somebody, because he's not going to find it in the bars on Friday night.
That is true. I knew of an escort who he was asked to do some very strange things.
Yes. Okay. Kevin Connor, being this hooker with a heart of gold, he has this wonderful friendship with someone who is an older man who was married, a very successful businessman, and he left to his family when the kids were grown so that he could be gay. Well, not so he could be gay, but so that he could be comfortable with being gay and so that he could, you know, live his life as an out gay man, and his children never forgave him. But Kevin goes over and visits, and they talk about all sorts of things. They talk about books. They talk about art. He teaches Kevin about finances and the like. And it is a very deep, caring friendship. One day at the beginning of the book, after he finishes up with a client, he goes over there to return a book to Alan, which is a Gore Vidal book. And he read it. He had, you know, wanted to discuss it with him. He gets there and there's a crowd out front, and Alan is dead on the sidewalk, having come out of his window. The police think that it's a suicide. He's convinced that it's murder. And as all these amateur sleuth series start, he's got to do his own investigating because the police are not exactly interested in any alternative theories.
And they certainly wouldn't be willing to listen to an escort.
No, definitely not. So in addition to how funny and happy Kevin is, all of the supporting characters are just marvelous. One of the police officers turns out to be Tony Rinaldi. Tony Rinaldi was his first love in high school. They did absolutely everything together and discovered their sexuality together. Then Tony sends him an email saying, sorry, I've got to end it. I'm going off to college. Now he's run into him as a police officer, and Tony is married to a woman with a couple of kids, bunch of kids. Then Kevin's mother shows up and just basically moves into the house and, you know, takes over his bedroom. And despite his repeated protestations, she's very good hearted, but has no boundaries. Then Tony shows up and she says, Tony Rinaldi, are you two seeing each other again? And Tony says, no, I'm married. She's married. He said, to a woman. Tony says, yeah, I'm straight. Straight? You're not straight. That's it. Kevin's mother is calling him like she sees him. You are not straight. And the rest of the book goes along like that. There's every scene is a comedic gem, but there's a fair amount of tension and a lot of good mystery buried in it. The whole thing is incredibly well done. It deserved a 2009 Lambda Literary Award for Best Mystery. And I really wish he would be writing again.
I do too. He stopped years ago.
Stopped in 2012. So it's a fun recommendation. I agreed with Brad. He tried to steal my thunder, but I still got it.
I didn't know you were going to give it a fun, or I would have kept my mouth shut.
I tell you, what else would this book be? It's obvious to you even that it was a fun one.
It's two funs.
Two funs. So that's it. Requeer Tales is releasing its first book of 2021. It's called Mountain Climbing on Sheridan Square. It's a bookend to the skydiving at Christopher Street. And they're both by Stan Leventhal. If you like the first one, you'll like this one. It's not a mystery. It's a literary fiction piece about a young man, the same young man who was in the earlier book.
Okay. Did you have more?
No. I think that was it.
Okay. Thank you, Justine. I've got Edwin Hill as my guest today. And
okay.
So listen in. And next week, I'll have even more news at the beginning.
Oh, my goodness.
But I don't want to.
You said we were going to lengthen this part, and I thought we were going to have a lot more time for my recommendations. And nope, all the more time goes to your announcements.
You've been getting longer recommendations. Don't give me that. But next week's will be short and sweet because okay. I only have one.
Yeah, for now. You've got a whole week to come up with more.
I'll be like this week where I had notes galore and I only knew what half of them were and Justine couldn't help me. It was a much shorter announcement day than I thought it would be. So anyway.
Okay. Sounds good. I'll see you next week.
I'll see you then. Okay. Interact with other crime fiction fans and authors in our Game Mystery Thriller Suspense Fiction group on Facebook. Links are on our website, queerwritersofcrime.com. Edwin Hill's critically acclaimed crime novels include Watch Her, The Missing Ones, and Little Comfort. He has been nominated for Edgar and Agatha Awards, featured in Us Magazine, received starred reviews in Publishers Weekly, Booklist, and Library Journal, and was recognized as one of six crime writers to watch in Mystery Scene Magazine. He lives in Roslindale, Massachusetts with his partner Michael and his favorite reviewer, their lab, Edith Ann, who likes his first drafts enough to eat them. Welcome to the show, Edwin.
Oh, thanks for having me, Brad. I'm so happy to be here today.
I'm excited to have you on. And before we get started with anything else, I want to bring up an event that's coming up that I'm actually very excited to be a part of, and it's Queer Noir at the Bar. And I'd like you to tell folks what that is and what it's about.
Oh, sure. I'm really excited about that, too. That event is on Friday, February 13th at 7 p.m. Eastern. And I think you can find links to it on this site. But Noir at the Bar, if you think about Noir at the Bar, in regular times, Noir at the Bar is held at a bar. And you can kind of think of it as a poetry slam with murder. So you get a handful of writers together and they bring their friends to a bar. Everyone reads from something they're working on and everyone cheers them along as they're reading. When the pandemic first started, I thought it would be fun to try and replicate Noir at the Bar online. So I started hosting an event called Noir at the Bar New England and got a bunch of New England authors together. We did it twice a month for a couple months. We got some New England authors together to read and everyone sort of enjoyed it. And you're supposed to bring your own drink along. We tried to replicate the experience as much as we could of being in person. So on February 13th, John Copenhaver and Brenda Buchanan will be hosting a Queer Noir at the Bar, which will feature a whole bunch of different authors. I think some of them have been on the show before. And I think one very special author will be featured. Who might that be, Brad?
I believe it's me.
Yes, it is. Yay.
I hope that's who you're referring to.
That's exactly who I was referring to. I'm really excited to hear you read.
We actually have quite a few. You mentioned John Copenhaver. He's been on the show twice. And Darma Kelleher has been on the show twice. And other guests that we have had been Anne Laughlin and Wendy Hurd. And then we did a book recommendation for Meredith Dench. So some of the folks will be familiar with the people that are going to be on the Queer Noir.
Nice. Yeah. So we all read for about 5 minutes. And John and Brenda are going to be doing most of the hosting and chatting. So they'll have some fun facts about each of the authors. And it's just a really fun night. I hope people can join us.
Well, I think it's a great idea with the, I hate to say it, the pandemic going on, that you came up with this great idea to get people interacting in the best way they can, like they used to.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a good way. I think we're all getting used to Zoom, being online and chatting with each other. I hope to be able to do events in person in the very near future. But for now, we're making the best of a rotten situation.
Yeah, it's funny. Everybody's used to Zoom now. Other podcasters tell me, oh, you should try this system and this system. And I'm like, everybody knows Zoom. I don't have to teach anybody anything. Just tell them to dial in. So I'm sticking with it for now.
Yep, I agree.
So you have written three mysteries, Hester Thursby mysteries?
Yep.
Okay. Tell us about Hester. Who is she?
Okay, yeah. So there are three books in the series. The first one is called Little Comfort. The second one is called The Missing Ones. And the third one, which just came out, is called Watch Her. They all center on Hester Thursby, who is a research librarian at Harvard University. She also, on the side, she finds missing people. So she's sometimes hired by other people to find missing people. That's sort of how Little Comfort starts. And then other times she just kind of falls into the story for various reasons. She never falls into the story. She becomes part of the story for various reasons. So Hester's a librarian. She lives in Somerville, Massachusetts. For anyone who's not from around here, Somerville is basically right next to Boston and sort of adjacent to Cambridge. She works at Harvard's Widener Library, which is the world's largest research library. And she specializes in Americana. So she really loves things like movies. She loves horror movies. She loves really rotten TV. But she also loves things like world fairs and circuses and things like that. So she really gets into pop culture of many different decades. She lives with her longtime partner, her longtime boyfriend, whose name is Morgan McGuire. Morgan is a veterinarian, and the two of them are raising a child who her name is Kate, and they age through the series. So Kate is 4 in the first book, and she's 6 by the time the third book comes out.
I like it when characters age. It makes me feel a little more comfortable than when they just stay the same age forever.
Me too.
Now, what is the overall arc of the three stories?
Sure. So the overall, I mean, there's a deep mystery in each of the story, but the sort of the emotional arc of the three stories begins with the first book, of course, with Little Comfort. At the beginning of that book, Morgan has a twin sister named Daphne. And Daphne, right before the start of that book, has skipped town and left her child in Hester and Morgan's care, and that's Kate. And Hester she's a 36-year-old woman. She's never had kids by choice, and she's not too thrilled with having this child dumped on her. And at the same time, Morgan isn't really providing enough support to her as her partner. So she really feels like she's sort of stuck with this kid on her own. And so the arc of those three novels is really Hester sort of coming to terms with the fact, I mean, she's an adult the whole time. She knows she has to take care of this kid and be an adult, but she doesn't necessarily have to be happy about it. And so the arc of the story is really her coming to terms with that, really finding some joy and comfort in taking care of this child. Hester and Morgan are also, they tend to be a little bit curmudgeonly and push people off. But one of the things I've really explored with this series is how in secret, they sort of open their world to lots of people who come into their lives. So throughout the entire series so far, they sort of collected people, and not in a creepy way, in a good way. They've sort of collected these these broken and not necessarily sad, but people who just need help along the way. They've sort of opened their house and welcomed these people into their lives. And there have been a whole bunch of them. Now there's a whole troop of them, and I sort of have to manage which ones sort of take prominent roles in each novel and which ones sort of fall into the background.
Yeah, when you write mysteries, when you say they collect people, you do have to qualify what that means.
Yes, yes.
Can you tell us about some of the other characters, any of the secondary ones?
Sure. One of my favorite characters that sort of, I love characters that come out of the writing process, ones that you didn't necessarily start the novel with, but sort of evolve as you're writing a book and or a series, and they sort of become standout characters. So when I was working on Little Comfort, there was a murder, and about two-thirds of the way through the book, and it is a murder mystery after all. And so there needed to be a police detective to come and investigate that murder. And so I came up with this character. She didn't even have a name for a little while, but she ultimately had a name. Her name is Angela White. She's a detective with the Boston Police Department. At first, I just had her in a couple of scenes, kind of basically doing her job in the background. But then as I kept revising that job, she kept getting a larger and larger role. And it was kind of interesting when I was touring for that book, when I was talking to readers were like almost universally said, we loved that character, Angela White. You need to do more with her. And so one of the real joys of writing a series, of course, is that you can do that. You can bring characters back that readers really like. You can listen to the things that readers like about a series. So when I was in the middle of working on The Missing Ones, the second book in the series. And so I made sure to sort of open up a storyline for Angela in that novel as well. It was definitely a secondary role. She didn't have a primary role in the book, and I didn't have enough time to go back and sort of make that role primary. So when I started writing Watcher, it was really exciting because I felt like I could finally really dig into who Angela White was as a character. So Angela is a police detective with the Boston Police Department. She's married to a woman named Carrie, and they live with Carrie's son from a prior relationship, whose name is Isaiah. And so a couple of things that I really liked about exploring about Angela in this book was her home life. You know, we get to know Carrie and Isaiah a little bit. Carrie's first wife, whose name is Brenda, comes around the house a lot. And Angela, we get to sort of see Angela's prickly side as well. Angela really can't stand Brenda, even though Brenda's as nice as can be to her. And she, you know, she gets a little prickly whenever Brenda comes around. She also doesn't like being sort of the third parent in the parenting wheel of taking care of Isaiah. And I also, I mean, all of my books sort of have morally ambiguous endings, I guess is a good, or they have some moral ambiguity to them. So one of the things that I really liked was being able to bring in some of that ambiguity to some of the actions that Angela does in Watch Her. I don't want to give away too much because that definitely would give away some of the end of the story.
Yeah, and I got to say, it's interesting to me when you're talking about a secondary character that you develop further. In my first novel, I have a character. She wasn't a tossaway character. She was necessary to the novel, but I really didn't plan on carrying her any further than that. And people loved her. And I didn't think I didn't even think there was enough for people to really care. And they just, there were so many comments that, you know, I've had to develop the character more. So it just happens that way.
Yeah, it's fun when that happens too.
Exactly. And you're in Roslindale. Is that outside of Boston?
It's a part of Boston, actually. Boston, I mean, it's not a gigantic city, but it has a bunch of different neighborhoods, and Roslindale is one of them.
Well, I love Boston, and if it wasn't for my husband, who cannot stand the cold, I would probably live there.
Oh, well, it's about 4 degrees out today, so today is not a day to try and tempt him.
No, absolutely not. He doesn't want desert. He doesn't want cold. I don't know where we're going to live. We'll find a place. Librarian. Hester is a librarian, which I find interesting because if somebody told me they wrote a mystery with a librarian, I would expect it to be a cozy mystery. And here you have more of a thriller.
Yeah, these are thrillers, and they have some violence and swearing in them. They're definitely not cozies. I love cozies, but these books are definitely not cozies. So I was When I came up with the, you know, like a lot of people, I took a long time on my first novel. I both was teaching myself how to write a full-length novel and dealing with, you know, all of the things that you deal with when you're writing a first novel, finding the time to write it, finding someone to actually give you a chance and take a look at it. So I worked on Little Comfort for, you know, maybe 3 or 4 years, and it went through many different iterations, but almost from the start, I knew I wanted to have the story be an amateur sleuth story. And so I was looking around for what careers the amateur sleuth could have. And I went through a bunch of different careers that Hester could have. For a while, she was going to be a psychologist. But I thought there are a lot of novels out there with psychology at the center of them. And I feel like there are a lot of authors who do that really, really well. And I was trying to find something different to do. So one day, Somerville and Cambridge are right next to each other. And Harvard obviously is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I was walking through the Harvard campus and I looked up and there was Widener Library right in front of me. Widener Library is enormous, by the way. It's an enormous building that was built around 1920 or so. And it's beautiful. And I looked at it and thought, librarians, they are people who, they know how to find things, they know how to find information, and they know how to interpret that information. And they also have access to information that your average person doesn't necessarily have. And more than that, librarians are very curious people. They're people that want to find things out. And so I thought that would be a really interesting character to center the story around.
So would you say Hester is a kick-ass librarian?
She does kick ass quite a bit. I mean, in the first novel, she's like kidnapped and thrown in a trunk and driven up into the wilds of New Hampshire and has to fight off a serial killer with an axe. So, I mean, she is definitely someone who can hold her own in a terrifying situation. She's also only 4'9¾ inches tall, so she pulls her strength from many places.
That's awesome. How was it as a male writing a female character? Was it tricky at all to do that?
You know, I think writing any character is really writing any character is tricky because you're not really writing about yourself, and so you need to inhabit the character and make the character feel authentic to your readers. All of these novels kind of follow the same format. They're told from four point of views. So Hester is one point of view, and then there are three other points of view in each of the novels. So Hester usually winds up having about 40% of the story, like she tells 40% of the story, and then I split the remaining 60% between the other three narrators. It's never exactly that, but that's about what I try and get it to be. And so whenever I'm developing any of the point of view characters, they're never really me. I'm of a certain age and I'm a gay man of a certain age, and none of the characters that I've written have been that person. And so I'm always looking for asking myself, how do I make this character that I'm working on, who's telling the story right now, feel as authentic as possible? When I'm working on Hester, you know, I do, you know, I try and place myself in her mind as far as how she interacts with the world. As I'm writing that, I try to make it feel authentic. And then after I'm done with the novel, I have a series of beta readers who read the novel for me. And I always look for people who kind of are like the people I'm representing, so that they can tell me, did this feel inauthentic to you? Like, was there something that didn't feel right here? And I'm trying to think of a good example now for Hester. And of course, I'm drawing a blank. But every time I do that, every time I give that novel to a beta reader, who is a woman, that I'd get most of it right. I'm going to give myself credit for that, but I always get like something wrong, some little thing wrong. And what I really am grateful for is when the beta reader can say, you might just adjust this a little bit, or you might take this line out or whatever. And so that I'm able to do that. I feel like those little things are the things that can really throw readers off when they're reading through something.
Yeah, it's great to have a really good beta readers, and it's a struggle sometimes to get the ones that are just, it's a nice book.
Oh, yeah. No, I want a beta reader to really tell me what's not working.
Yeah, that doesn't help you too much.
No.
So Watcher is the third in the series. Can we expect a fourth of Hester?
I have one in mind. Right now I'm working on a standalone book that's sort of in the Hester Thursby universe. So a couple of the recurring characters show up in it, but Hester and Morgan and Kate are not part of the story. They're sort of referenced, like one of the characters talks about her librarian friend, but that's as far as Hester comes into the story. So when I finish this book, I have an idea for a fourth Hester Thursby novel. So I sort of tried to treat these first three books as a story arc. So like I finished up some of the recurring stories for Hester and Morgan and Kate in these three novels. So I want to start a new story arc with my next three novels. And one of the things I want to get into is Hester's been estranged from her mother she's almost 40 now, and she's been estranged from her mother since she was 18. So that's a good long time. And so I want to start exploring that relationship. In the next book, Hester's going to have to go to her hometown and help her and sort of mend fences with her mother because her mother's in trouble for having done something. So that's about as far as I've gotten with that novel. So I do know all the novels are set here in New England. I sort of try and explore different areas of New England with each story. So the first one was set in, part of the story was set up in New Hampshire in the Lakes District. In the second story, a lot of the novel was set on an island off the coast of Maine. In the third story, I set it all in a neighborhood of Boston called Jamaica Plain, which is kind of a very beautiful and urban part of the city. And then for the third one, and for this fourth one, I'm going to set it down by the Cape. It's going to be in a beach town, and it'll be in the summer because you only want to go to beach towns in the middle of the summer.
Yeah, there's something about just writing about a place that you're comfortable with. And I've lived in California for 20 years, and my stories take place in LA. And I can't imagine going elsewhere. I had a book idea that would take place in the Outer Banks of North Carolina, which is where I grew up. And so much has changed there. It would require that I would go there and spend so much time researching. And it just wouldn't feel the same to me.
But I'm curious. I have a novel I have on the back burner right now that's set in New York and in San Francisco. I lived in San Francisco for many years. And I did set it in the San Francisco parts. I did set in the 90s when I lived there. Actually, that's not true. Part of it set in the 90s and part of it set in the current day. But there was something refreshing about moving out of New England when I was working on that novel. It was just kind of fun to look at a different part of the world.
Speaking of San Francisco, you were out there as part of the tech boom, I believe.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I lived out there. And then, I mean, when I graduated from college, it was the middle of a recession and I didn't have a job. And what better decision to make than to move across like 3,000 miles across the country and move to a brand new city? So I did that. I moved across the country to San Francisco. At the time, you know, it was a lot cheaper there than it is now. I moved into the Mission with some roommates and just had a great time for a couple of years. It was impossible to find a job for me, at least. And so I temped for a year or two. And then, you know, things started to change. I mean, the dot-com boom really started sort of in the mid-late 90s. And it just became a really crazy and exciting time when there were a lot, you know, people were doing really fun, interesting things. There were a lot of like instant millionaires, and then they'd like lose the money the next day and stuff like that. And so that was just sort of fun to be part of that as it was going on. You know, it changed San Francisco very quickly. And when that all came crashing down in the year 2000. And, you know, at that point, I just decided I would leave California and come back to Boston.
And so how did you go from the tech industry to becoming a writer? What was that process?
Oh, goodness, Brad. It was a very long one. I mean, I'd always liked writing. I always liked the idea of writing. I had a lot of self-doubt about it, though. So, you know, I would start a lot of novels and get maybe 20 or 30 pages into them and just never could quite get over that hump. I think a lot of writers do this. I think it's easy to start a novel. You have a good concept. And then as you sort of start heading out of that first act and into the middle of the novel, it just, you know, you get lost in the murk of plotting. And so I did that many, 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 many times. And when I left San Francisco, I decided I wanted to try it. So I went and got an MFA at Emerson College here in Boston. And, you know, I worked on a novel, and an MFA takes 2 years to get. So I worked on the novel for those 2 years. And when I graduated, I actually had something, which was great. And it was really nice to go to the MFA. It was great to have, you know, students who could give you feedback and instructors who could really encourage you along the way. And I think that was having that structure really helped me complete something. So I graduated from Emerson. That was in the early 2000s. And I had this novel and I sent it out. I started querying to get agents. And I got an agent. I got a fancy agent in New York, and it was really exciting. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, here I am. I've arrived. And we shot that novel around New York, and nobody wanted it. It didn't sell. And so at that point, I had no money left, and because I had just gone through grad school. And so I got a job in publishing. I worked in publishing. I worked in college publishing, not in trade publishing. And I worked in publishing for almost 20 years. It was a great career. I had some great successes, and it was wonderful people. And but about, you know, around 10 years after that first novel that didn't sell, I started getting the itch to try writing again. And so I started a new novel, and that wound up turning into A Little Comfort. Again, it wasn't a short time between me deciding to start that second novel and finally getting an agent and finishing it. But it was just keeping my nose to the grindstone and really trying to push through when the story wasn't coming to me, or I kind of didn't know where to go, or, you know, when I had gotten a lot of rejection letters or anything like that.
So when you got that itch for that first novel to publication, how long of a period was that?
For A Little Comfort?
Yes.
Let's see. I started working on that book probably not in earnest, like very, very not in earnest. I started working on that book in 2008, but I didn't really, really start working on it until the middle of 2010. I got a new job. I went from one publishing house to another publishing house, and I negotiated a month off in between the two jobs. And so for that whole month, I worked on drafting a novel. So I sort of did my own private version of NaNoWriMo. And so from that moment on, that's when I really started to really focus on it. So I worked on it that was October of 2010. And I finished it toward the end of 2013. So I worked on it for about 3 years straight. And then I got, again, just like my first novel, I got an agent relatively quickly. But then we had trouble selling the book, and it had to go through a number of revisions. And so I wound up selling it on November 9th, 2016. And I will tell you this, look at that date on a calendar. I was the only happy person in my office that day.
Now, in a world where so many people are self-publishing, why did you take the direction to go with a traditional publisher?
Oh, you know, I think part of it was just ignorance. I didn't really know a lot about self-publishing at the time. I really love the editorial process, and I know you can replicate anything that I'm about to say in self-publishing, but I love the editorial process. I love the back and forth between an editor and a writer. When I was trying to sell my first novel too, I had a very demanding full-time job at the time, and I think to be successful as a self-publisher, you have to be able to do a lot of different things. You need to be able to do your own marketing. You need to be able to do your own, not necessarily do all these things, but you need to manage all of those things. And I was really hoping to have someone else do some of the stuff like cover design, book design, copy editing, proofreading, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, to go to a stereotype, generally speaking, artists in general don't like marketing. So when you self-publish, that's probably the most difficult part. Well, writing a book is not so easy either. But when you're done and you think, I'm done, there's a lot of work ahead of you.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So, okay, you've got your first two books. First one was Little Comfort, and that won an Agatha nominee for Best First Novel.
Mm-hmm.
And your second one, The Missing Ones, Sue Grafton Memorial Award. That was your second book. So your first two books, you kind of really hit it out of the ballpark. How did that feel?
Oh, gosh, it was awesome. I mean, you know, you work on a novel for it. I mean, like writing is, I would say two things. Writing is sort of an individual sport, but it's also a team sport. But the individual sport part of writing is a long one, and it's a lonely one. You spend just a lot of time sitting in a room, like looking at a screen or looking at a piece of paper and trying to make something work. And so I was shocked when Little Comfort came out and like a single person read it, I was shocked, let alone that like an organization would have identified it as like best of anything. So I was like stunned and amazed and very, very grateful both times. The Missing Ones was nominated for an Agatha for best novel as well. So that was amazing as well.
Well, it's funny, the part about being lonely as a writer is a very lonely position. And I think that's why a lot of authors get lost on Facebook and other social media, because they start to reach out and get a little connection, and it's very easy to just fall in that rabbit hole. Has that happened to you?
Well, I try not to. I'm sort of on a social media break right now. I mean, social media is something you sort of have to do for marketing and promotion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily like it, and I find it can be very negative. So I try to avoid it here and there. However, I do a few things to keep myself from being distracted by the world. And the best thing that I did was I invested in this app called Freedom. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but Freedom, I mean, oh, the irony, you have to use an app to save yourself from technology. But Freedom is this app that you put on your phone, and it blocks all of your internet for a set amount of time. So I set Freedom every morning from 8:30 until 12:30. I can't access any of the internet. I can't access social media, anything like that. And that's my time for writing and for revising my novels.
Okay. I am writing that in big, bold letters, Freedom. I need that.
Oh, it's like, I have to say, it was a real lifesaver. I find writing, especially when I'm writing a first draft, which can be so daunting and frustrating, I would be distracted by anything. And so I'd find like a whole day would go by, and I'd done exactly what you're just saying, been on social media, which is, for me, is a waste of time.
Yeah, Michael Nava is currently on a social media break, and when he announced it, I thought, I want to do the same, but between the podcast and my novels, it's really hard to stay off of social media.
Mm-hmm.
You need it for those reasons.
Well, I have this book that I'm promoting right now, so I kind of have to be on social media for the next, you know, month or so, but after that, I'm going to take a full-on break, I think.
Well, good for you. I don't know if I could do that. I'll have to try someday. So, I like to find out, other than writing, what other authors are passionate about. So what other things are your passion?
Well, oh gosh, it's funny because, of course, we've been stuck inside for so long. It's hard to remember sometimes what your passions are. But I love to spend time outdoors. My partner, Michael, and I go hiking a lot up here in New England. We also like to travel around and go hiking in other parts of the world. A couple of years ago, we did a hike in the UK called the Coast to Coast Trail, which is one where you walk all the way across England. You sort of start on the Irish Sea and you end on the North Sea. And that took about 2 weeks, and it was unbelievably fun and beautiful and picturesque. And we met all sorts of fun people along the way. The idea of being able to sort of be outside with people you don't know and then end the night in a pub, a crowded pub with a bunch of people you don't know who sort of become friends with you become friends with over the course of 2 weeks is like something that I think so many of us yearn for right now. That is, anyway, that's something that I really like to do. I like to ski too. I really love animals. I have a dog named Edith Ann, and I like to work with animals a lot too.
Like most authors, are you also an avid reader?
Oh, yeah, I read all the time. I read a lot of mystery, a lot of crime novels, and then I also tend toward literary fiction as well. I like true crime. I don't read a ton of nonfiction, but I do like to read true crime here and there.
Yeah, I keep telling myself, Brad, you need to read something other than mysteries. Spread out. You'll learn something else. And when it comes time to pick up a book, it's always a mystery. And I really need to get over that.
you know, I have to tell you, I had a project that I was working on last year, and I read mysteries nonstop. And I just finished that project, and I picked up a novel that came out maybe 8 or 9 years ago. It's called The Interestings, and it's by, Meg Wolitzer, I think her name is. And it's a literary novel. It's about a group of kids who go to a camp, an arts camp, and then it follows them through many years of their life. And it was kind of refreshing to read something that was non-crime oriented and where there were no murders, you know, and it wasn't, you aren't trying to always guess what, outguess the author.
Yeah, that'd be tough. I'll have to try it. I'll force myself the next book that comes around. So let's go back to Hester. Well, it's really about you. If I asked Hester Thursby about you, what would she tell me?
Oh, goodness. Well, she would say that I am not efficient enough in my writing. And she would also say that she should come over and help me with my research, because research is definitely the part of writing that I like the least. But no, she and I would be buds, because we do have some things in common. I think oftentimes when you write a series character like that, you do pull from your own life. So the things that Hester and I have in common are, We both like to watch movies, and we both like to watch horror movies, especially horror movies from the 80s. We like all sorts of terrible movies from the 80s and terrible TV shows. We also are both complete slobs, and we both are a little bit curmudgeonly and yet kind at the same time. So I think I sort of pulled that part of her character from my own life. What else would she say about me? You know, I think we'd get along. I think we both like to sit at a bar and have a drink and chat with a couple of people. And I think we'd have a fun time doing that together.
Well, you're a man after my own heart. The 80s, there were so many bad horror films.
Oh, gosh, they're terrible, but they're wonderful.
I know, isn't that the truth? So I always call them deliciously bad.
Yes. There are a couple of homages to the horror movies in the novels. Like, there's an homage to The Shining in the first book in Little Comfort. If you remember, it's very famous, I'm sure everyone remembers it, when Wendy is trying to escape out of a window and she can't get out, so she shoves her son out through the window. And then, of course, Jack knocks down the door with an axe. So there's a little homage to that scene in Little Comfort. And then I have other homages to horror movies in the other two books as well.
So what did you think of the movie, The Shining?
Oh, you know, I like it a lot. I loved it when I was a kid. When I watch it now, it seems, you know, the way things age, is it's interesting. It does seem a little bit slower than it used to. But I think it's a really interesting movie. And I think some of the choices that were made in making it were really interesting. I like the book. I don't like the book as much as I like the movie.
Oh, really? I found the book much more terrifying. You know, Stephen wasn't all that thrilled with the movie.
Oh, yeah, I know that.
Yep. Okay, not to give anything away, there's a scene in the book where the topiaries start attacking or moving. I can't remember the details, but it was a terrifying scene. But they left it out of the movie because they thought it would be too silly to see on the movie screen. And I think that was probably the right decision. Your mind can certainly play something much easier than your eyes can sometimes deal with it.
Oh, yeah, I can see. And especially, you know, with the technology of 1980, I'm sure it would have looked very fake.
Yeah, it would have looked really bad. I watched some of those that I used to think were great special effects, and I'm like, oh, that's terrible. Do you read your reviews?
My policy is no, but I always do.
It's hard not to, isn't it?
But, you know, I have a very, very thick skin. And, you know, I think you can learn things. Most of my reviews are really great, and they're very positive, and I'm very appreciative of that. When I do get a bad review, you know, either someone just didn't like the book, which is fine, or I can learn something from something that they say. I think, you know, I think most reviews, most very bad reviews, we weren't on the same page. I wasn't on the same page as the reader, and that's absolutely fine. I do really love the super mean ones, though. I mean, like the really, really nasty ones. They kind of make me laugh.
Yeah, the really nasty ones are easy to kind of look over. One thing that drives me crazy now is Amazon has gone the route of Goodreads, where people can just leave a star and don't have to write a review, which, as an author, that's not helpful to me at all.
Oh, I didn't know that Amazon had decided to do that. That's interesting.
Yeah,
that doesn't help.
Up until recently, they were required to write something, and now they don't have to anymore. Same thing with the podcast. You mentioned that the negative reviews that you've learned from some of them, what has there been that you've been able to incorporate into your writing?
You know, it's interesting. I would just say, as far as I've definitely learned some stuff around character development, you know, and around making sure, this is a good one. What I've learned is making sure that you're getting some details right, all the details right when you're writing about a real local place. There are just a few small details in my first book. All my books are set in Boston. And I got a couple things wrong in my first book. And it was just because I wasn't paying attention, or, you know, I just kind of didn't go back and fix something that I should have. And so people really take that kind of thing seriously. The people who take that kind of thing seriously take it very, very seriously. So it just taught me to make sure when I'm mentioning something real, something that actually exists in Boston, that I make sure that I'm representing it exactly right. And I'll give you an example. In my current book, Watch Her, there's a scene that takes place in a restaurant in Boston called the Corrib. And for some reason, I kept getting this one detail right. Hester goes and she parks in a parking lot across the street from the Corrib. And for some reason, I thought it was a CVS, like a CVS parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I rode by there one day and I was like, oh, it's not a CVS parking lot. It's a parking lot for a bank. And like, if I had left in the CVS parking lot, like I would have gotten notes about that, because people who care about those things really care about those things.
Oh yeah. You would have heard about it, no doubt. So now I hope you're excited, because you've been hounding me to do this. I've brought back awkward questions authors get.
Oh, great.
So you get to be the first one that I've done in months.
All righty.
So I'm going to spin the wheel and we'll see what you get.
Okay.
Okay. So sit back and be ready for this one, Edwin. Are you talented or lucky?
Oh, goodness. That's an interesting question, right? Because everything is part luck, you know? But everything is also... writing is getting a book published is challenging. And you have to have a lot of things sort of line up to make it work out. And part of that is luck. There's just no getting around it. But part of it is putting your nose to the grindstone and actually doing the work. So I'll tell you this. I wrote a book a long time ago. I wrote a book in the early 2000s, right out of my MFA program. And one of the steps that you have to go through to get a book published is you need to find an agent. And so I found an agent really, really quickly. And that makes people, like people who've been looking for an agent, that makes them their skin crawl, because finding an agent can be really, really challenging. So I found an agent really quickly. I thought everything was working out for me. And she was a big, well-known agent in New York. And we shopped that novel all around New York. And it got rejected absolutely everywhere. And I got really discouraged and I gave up on writing for a number of years. So then I wrote my second, that novel never was published. I wrote my second novel, which is Little Comfort. And guess what? I got an agent really quickly again. And he shopped that novel all around New York and it got rejected everywhere again. And when that happened, I thought to myself, what can I do now? Like, this has happened to me twice. And I thought to myself, the first time that this happened, I gave up. The only thing I can do now is either give up or just keep trying. And that's when I took out those rejection letters and I started analyzing and I figured out that the novel needed another revision. So I put my nose to the grindstone and I spent another year revising that novel. And then it got published. And the funny thing is when I was writing my second novel, The Missing Ones, I thought to myself, well, I have that old novel that we tried to sell way back in the early 2000s. I could try dusting that off and see if my new agent can sell that one, because I was still working full time and I kind of wanted something easy. So I pulled out that manuscript and I read about 10 pages of it. And I thought to myself, well, now I know why that book never sold, because you know what? It stunk. And so I guess I was lucky because you know what? You don't want a book that really stinks to sell either. So there's some luck there as well. So there is a really, really long answer to your short question.
I actually think it can only be answered in a long way because I think the answer is both. I self-publish, but if you're looking, going the traditional route like you did, you could write a brilliant novel, but if it gets to an agent or publisher who's not in the mood for that type of story, even that particular day, you can get rejected.
Yeah. You can get rejected. And what I say, the counter statement to that is you only need one path through. You just have to find that path. So if you submit to 10 agents and only one of them says yes, well, guess what? You only needed that one yes. And if that agent submits to 10 publishers and only one of them says yes, you only needed that one yes.
Good way to put it. Well, Edwin, it has been great having you on as a guest.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
And so our listeners, just to remember, the guest today is Edwin Hill. He writes the Hester Thursby mystery series and the latest novel that came out in December.
Yep.
Was Watcher.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Okay. And as always, I'll have plenty of links in the show notes.
Thanks so much for having me, Brad.
Oh, thank you for being on. Be sure to subscribe to Queer Writers of Crime wherever you hear our show. Tell a friend too. Thank you for listening.